Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, the Sydney Writers' Festival was on recently, and it's always a bit of a feast for readers. And this year was no exception, with something like 300 events and writers and speakers from around the world.
This year, the theme was how to live, and there were sessions on everything from narcissism to non-monogamy to love, war, old age, education, and a little bit of religion. The theme allowed for a pretty varied program.
I have to say, I think a little bit of religion is a lot more than we're used to seeing.
Yes, that's fair.
From the Sydney Writers' Festival. Now, Natasha, you went to quite a few events. Did you have any favourites?
Well, my absolute favourite was a talk by Robert Desay, who's an Australian novelist. He spoke about Enid Blyton as his greatest influence, and that was just delightful.
I love Enid Blyton too, I have to admit.
Yes. I mean, I think from a life and faith perspective, you know, things that I think might interest our listeners. Not that there aren't a lot of Enid Blyton fans out there, but there were two events in particular that stood out. So one was one of the kind of high-flying panels of the week called How to Live, after the conference theme. And that featured people like Anne Mann, Douglas Copeland, and Hugh McKay. And it like ranged over topics from Facebook to monarch butterflies to Andreas Lubitz, the pilot who deliberately crashed his plane into the Alps earlier this year. The other event was with an American writer, Caitlin Doty, who has written a book about her experiences working at a crematorium and about how badly our culture deals with death as a whole, or, you know, doesn't deal with it at all.
We will get to that panel, but Caitlin Doty, she's a mortician.
She is. She worked in a crematorium for several years, and she's now opening her own funeral home in LA. It's called Undertaking LA.
Nice.
You know, kind of fun. She's all about bringing death back into our culture. So she says that we've kind of evacuated and sanitized death, and that that's actually really unhealthy and unhelpful. So she's founded what she calls a death acceptance collective with other death professionals or practitioners, but also academics and artists and that kind of thing.
I can imagine it's an interesting experience to write death professional on your, you know, declaration at the airport for,
yeah,
your, for what you do.
You probably get some inquiries at customs.
Yes. How do you think you become that kind of person, or like a death professional?
Well, she did talk about kind of her background and how she became so interested in death and the death industry. She talks about how when she was a child, maybe about 8 years old, she was living in Hawaii with her family, and they went to a shopping centre one day, and she actually saw a small child fall from a couple of floors up.
Whoa.
And was killed. And, you know, she saw this happen and was really traumatized by it. But, you know, the body was cleared away straight away. Her parents wouldn't talk to her about it. She had no one to talk to, and kind of turned inwards and was really frustrated by that sense of not being able to discuss, you know, what had happened and what that meant with anyone. So she's kind of set herself this task of getting these things openly talked about again. And among other things, she started a YouTube series called Ask a Mortician, which is actually quite fun.
Well, we have a clip actually from the very first episode of Ask a Mortician. Here it is.
This is episode one of Ask a Mortician. The premise is really, really self-explanatory. You ask a question about death, dying, decomposition, mourning, funeral customs, etc., and I will answer it. I've been in the funeral industry for almost 4 years. I am a licensed mortician working in California. I have a website, and it's about bringing mortality back into culture, which is what you're doing right now by watching this video. Question one comes from Michael in Chicago. Dear mortician, how long does rigor mortis last?
Yeah, she has a lot of personality. She's very upbeat compared to what you might expect an undertaker to be like. And she has loads of fascinating stories about the mechanics of how we as a culture deal with the dead. So with the corpses themselves, as well as, you know, the process of mourning and grieving.
And she's written a book, hasn't she? It also sounds like she has a sense of humour, because it's called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and it's mostly about her experiences of working in a crematorium.
Yeah, and it really doesn't pull any punches. So at the Writers' Festival event, she talked about the kinds of lengths that morticians have to go to make a corpse look, you know, elegant and peaceful. You know, apparently it's really difficult to get dead people's eyes and mouth to stay shut, and there are some pretty horrific things that they do to...
I think we all have an image in our head now.
Yeah. You probably have to read the book to find out. But yeah, lots of things you don't really think of. She talked about how in a crematorium you have to burn the larger people, of which, as she pointed out, there are a lot in America, at the beginning of the day, and what happens if you don't do it to the end of the day. It's quite... There were some quite graphic stories that she told.
You've left a question in my mind, at least, but I won't go there. It sounds quite morbid.
It does. And there, I suppose there's kind of a morbid fascination to it all. But it's also not, in that she really wants to argue that dignity in death is kind of what you make of it. And we in our culture kind of have it wrong when we want to sideline all the kind of gritty detail of death and pretend that it doesn't happen, that people essentially don't die. And when they do, which of course everyone does, we outsource the whole process to professionals. So, you know, like, I've been alive for more than 30 years, I've never seen a dead person. That's weird, you know, culturally and historically speaking, that's really strange.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of those intense sort of BBC dramas where someone dies and they bring the body in and put it on the kitchen table.
Yeah,
and you know, that just doesn't happen anymore.
Wakes and open caskets, like, we rarely have open caskets anymore. And she kind of points out that actually the dead are everywhere. Like, if you go on a flight, there are probably corpses in the cargo hold. But, you know, we go to great lengths never to see them. So in the West today, we have this quite contradictory attitude towards death and the dead. You know, we want to say that death is just a natural part of life, but we also find the whole thing terrifying and just want to avoid it at all costs.
I think Christians would agree with that idea, absolutely, that our culture isn't dealing well with death at all, really. I think that there is very much a current insistence on making funerals fun and celebrating someone's life. And that seems to me some kind of attempt to take away the sting of death. But I think it's right that, you know, we need to stop ignoring it and divorcing it from everyday life in such an absolute way.
Yeah, and I suppose the Christian idea of heaven, you know, if there being more life beyond death, that's often interpreted as denial or as wishful thinking. But secular culture has a fair bit of wishful thinking and denial going on in this area of its own. So one of the things that I think Christian thought has to add to this question of how we deal with death is that it does fully acknowledge that death is the enemy. Like, that's the language that Christians use. You know, it's not okay. And I think we feel that really strongly when someone does die. It's not just really sad, though it's that. It's also that it feels really wrong, that it's not meant to be that way. And Christian faith really validates that feeling.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe. Now, we've been debriefing on the Sydney Writers' Festival that happened recently. The theme was how to live. And Natasha, one of the events that you attended had a panel that was using that theme as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. The quote that the festival theme is based on is from Jean-Paul Sartre. So he apparently once said, everything has been figured out except how to live. And there does seem to be this general feeling that, you know, today we know so much about so much, but all the basic questions about meaning and purpose and happiness and morality, those are in a way as fresh and as puzzling as ever. So this panel had a pretty big brief to fill.
And it's quite a varied panel, just looking from the roll of names. We've got Anne Mann, who's written a book on narcissism. Hugh McKay, who's written most recently about our need for community in his book, The Art of Belonging. You've also got Douglas Copeland, the novelist, author of Generation X, who's currently artist in residence at Google in Paris. Yes, I'd love to write that on my resume. Paul Dolan from the London School of Economics. His book is Happiness by Design, Finding Pleasure and Purpose in Everyday Life. And Leanne Hennion, who's written a book called Phenomenal, about the wonder of the natural world. So we have social commentators, a novelist, an economist, and a hippie, it sounds like.
She was quite expressive.
Yes, so a very different bunch of people and approaches. Was there any consensus in what makes a good life and how to live a good life?
It's interesting how much they did agree on, in a way, considering how different their approaches are. I think part of it is that the same concerns came up for everyone. So there was quite a strong sense across the panel that maybe we as a culture, people have taken a wrong turn somewhere when it comes to happiness and fulfillment, whether it's because of the ways that capitalism has ordered our lives or the way that technology has changed the way that, you know, we manage our lives, that there's something key that we're missing in this area.
And is that missing key to do with happiness, this idea that we don't know how to be happy?
It's sort of that we don't know how to be happy, that's, you know, disputed, but it may also be more complicated. So a few of the panelists and even some of the audience members who ask questions were kind of saying that actually we do know how to be happy. So, for example, Hugh McKay pointed out that, you know, it's simple. All the evidence shows that living for other people is what makes us happy. We know that. But for some reason, we don't really do the things that we know will make us happy. Like there's some kind of failure of will somewhere.
Now, this is really familiar, don't you think? It's a very classical Christian idea, this idea that humans kind of know what they should do, but at the same time, we fail to actually follow through with that. We have this war within ourselves. And I guess if this was a cartoon, you'd have the angel on one shoulder telling us what we should do, and the devil on the other that tells us what we want to do, let's say. So this is kind of disorder that we experience in our own selves.
Yeah, and I think that sense of failure and conflict is maybe also a reaction against the idea that, you know, we just need to figure out who we are as individuals and be true to ourselves, and then we'll be fulfilled and happy. And actually, interestingly, there was a little bit of conflict within the panel on this. So Leanne Hennion, who wrote the book Phenomenal, her idea, she used this phrase, she talked about living the life that no one else could live. And the others quite strongly disagreed with her on that being kind of the route to happiness and fulfillment. So Hugh McKay pointed out that really you can go off and have adventures and be refreshed, and that's great. But the meaning of our lives is when you come back and you're building good relationships and good community. And Anne Mann pointed out that, you know, people like Andreas Lubitz and Anders Breivik, the guy in Norway who shot all these people, they could be said to be doing that, to be living a life unlike
anyone
people.
Else. Yeah.
Whereas the woman at home, this is the example Anne Mann gave, you know, a woman caring for her mother who has early onset Alzheimer's and is just getting through each day, that person isn't doing anything spectacular or unique, but maybe they're living a really good life.
I like hearing that from Anne Mann. Her book, which I've read, is wonderful. She spends so much time talking about how this narcissistic character type is becoming the figure of our time. But that we also need to talk about care, and, you know, her example of someone caring for their mother is a prime example of that. Anne Mann is really interesting, or her book is talking about narcissism and its growth among young people, particularly today, even though she does draw on the sort of big news stories like the Anders Breivik and Lance Armstrong, etc. I'm really intrigued by what she says, that the narcissist is both demanded by our highly competitive culture, but it's also produced by a whole range of social changes that have happened since the 60s. And she particularly draws attention to what she calls the great disembedding, quoting the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, of Western religion, Christianity, from Western society. So there's this loss of overarching meaning that grounded the self. And she says this is partly what's allowed the narcissist character type of today to run riot.
Yeah, one of the things she said on the panel was that there's been a real transition over the last few decades from people having a sense of themselves as living under the eye of God to now living under the eye of their peers. And that's a much more fragmented and a much less, you know, morally concerned position to be in. And there was this vibe from the whole panel really about that idea of a loss of overarching meaning. So Paul Dolan, who's the London School of Economics guy, he suggests that happiness is all about everyday moments, you know, letting go of those big narratives about our lives and trying to construct a kind of overall meaning. And I think that probably reflects the confusion that we have now about whether our lives do have bigger meaning other than just the day-to-day enjoyment or misery that we experience.
So even though Jean-Paul Sartre said that, you know, we've figured out everything except how to live, it looks like this panel hasn't necessarily gotten us very far on that question.
They haven't
either.
Solved the age-old question.
No. These are all questions that we wrestle with, and I imagine we'll continue to wrestle with as a culture. But if you want to read any of these books, we can highly recommend these highlights from the festival. Caitlin Doty's book about working in a crematorium, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, Hugh McKay's Art of Belonging, and Anne Mann's book, The Life of I, The New Culture of Narcissism. Join us next time on Life and Faith.